me to he was chairman of something called the American Bar Association Municipal Law Section, and the Municipal Law Section dealt with largely funding and instruments for funding, bonds and other instruments that municipalities and states and what have you would issue to fund their activities. To digress for one moment, he asked me to edit the Municipal Law Service letter. And he said, this is a publication that goes out to the American Bar Association members who belong to this section. And he said, we review cases and do this and do that. He said, I want you to put all that together and publish this newsletter and what have you. He said, at the same time, he said, I want you to do some research for me because I'm writing a case book on municipal law, and I want you to help me with the editing and the work on that. And then he said, I'm also going to do one on constitutional law, and I want you to help me with that if you possibly could. And then we did one on regulatory law as well, municipal law and regulatory law. So during the next 2 years, two summers, and during the year, I worked for him. And he brought me to Washington and introduced me to the people at what that time was in the Bureau of the Budget, which was the Legislative Reference Service. So we were working on a legislative book, and this was how laws were made and everything else. Okay. We did reviews on constitutional law. He gave me a problem. He said, you know, here is a case that we have, I want you to research and see what you can get me of any other case law. I worked one whole summer practically on that thing. It's just, you know, riveting. I found nothing. So when you find nothing in the case law in the United States, you look at comparative law. So I went off to England and I looked at the continent, and I ended up in Australia, and the Australian legislative legal system is similar to the United States. They also have a balance of powers structure down there in a Supreme Court. And eventually I found a case in the Supreme Court of Australia that I thought was on point for this, and I was extremely pleased. So I went in to see him at the end of the summer, and I was turning over, now here's what I've done on this, and, you know, you've gotten all my reports, and these are the chapters for that. And, oh, by the way, on this particular problem here, I have found a case. I said, it's not in the United States. He says, oh, is it that Australian case? Well, you know, to me, that was not a put-down. You know, to me, that just said, you know, this guy is so smart. And he wanted, he said, don't feel badly. He said, I didn't know that was all that was left. And he said, now I'm pretty sure that it is. You've made it clear to me that that's it. And I learned from that, you know, that there are different reasons why people do things. And research requires proof and vetting and checking and peer review and all that. So that was, I will say that working with, working for, Jeff Fordham, being allowed to accompany him to a lot of places, tried to make me a Democrat. He couldn't do that. But he was a wonderful man and treated me, despite the fact that his experiences and everything were so far beyond where I was at that stage of my life, but to treat me, you know, as a peer, to treat me as a colleague, which he did, was a huge step in my maturation. And so when you look back on people who impressed you or helped you, I would say that experience, personal experience, was enormous. The personal experiences with my father, you know, during the very difficult times of the Depression, that was important. I would say that when I got out of law school, I was married by the time I got out. I had my first child. And in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, you have a preceptor. And there was a law firm in Delaware County in Upper Darby that was my preceptor, and I did some work for them too. But by the time I got out of law school, the Korean War was well on. And I had this feeling. Now, I had been in the ROTC. when I was in college. Before I left college, I quit the ROTC. And I quit because I said, you know, there's nothing going on here, and I want to go to law school, so I'm not going to worry about the draft. If I get drafted, okay, but nothing's happening. So I got all the way through law school and everything. And when I got out, I said, you know, I just feel that I have an obligation, and I'm just concerned that people still get drafted. And even though I have a child and all of this, I enlisted. I enlisted in the Navy. And I said, I want to get this behind me. That's just how I feel about it. So I enlisted and was finally accepted. And I was going off to boot camp. And I was going to boot camp at, went to boot camp at Newport, Rhode Island. And when I got out of boot camp, they said, are you aware of the fact, you know, that you can be an officer so easy? It's just stupid for you to be an enlisted man. Just doesn't make any sense at all. You've got a law degree and you've got all this. And I said, well, whatever you think. And they said, well, just keep on going through this officer's class then. So I got out of Newport and I got a commission. And I went in the Navy, and I spent 3.5 years in the Navy. And because, interestingly enough, funny how things turn in your life, because I wore glasses, I could not get a line designator. Line officers were the ones that had the stars. The Supply Corps officers had oak leaves, and the medical officers had a different pyracantha leaf. So even though I was an officer, I couldn't be a line officer, so I had to go to Supply Corps school. If you went to Supply Corps school and did well, then you would immediately be sent to sea. So you'd get 1 year at sea, and then you'd be transferred back to land. If you didn't do well, then you wouldn't get independent duty right away. You'd be sent to a base somewhere, and then you'd spend the rest of your 3 years at sea somewhere. So I went to Georgia, and I got out of Supply Corps school, and I did well, and I was assigned to a destroyer, and I spent the better part of a year and a half on the destroyer. And we were headed for the Med, for the Suez thing, and I came down with something. What the hell was it? Oh. I had an ear infection and ended up with motion sickness, severe motion sickness. And the doctor on the boat, the ship with us, Marvis Marsteller, said, you can't go to the Med. He said, you've been on this ship now for a better part of a year. Every time we go out, you get sick as a bitch. I said, well, you know, as a kid, I was on boats all the time. He said, makes no difference. He said, it's relative movement, not, you know. He said, do you get car sick? I said, no, I've never been sick in a car in my life. He said, well, that's relative. You don't see any moving. He said, you got a problem here. So I went to, the ship went to the Suez, and I went to the Charleston, South Carolina Naval Hospital. I got out of the hospital. They gave me all these tests, and they said, you're never going to see again. That's all there is to it. So maybe we ought to kick you out of the Navy. I said, oh, that's fine. I said, do whatever you want to do. I don't care. You know, so they said, well, we're not going to kick you out of the Navy, for Christ's sake. That's stupid. First, this captain at the hospital made this decision. He said, I can either throw you out or not. He said, what do you want to do? I said, it's totally up to you. I said, I signed up for 3.5 years or 4 years, whatever I'm in for. I'll stay in if that's what you want me to do. I said, well, you can send me home. I don't care. And he said, well, I'm going to keep you in. I said, fine. So this is a huge Navy base. So they go over to the Navy depot there, and they say, we have this ensign. I was just about to make JG down here, and we'd like to send him over there. And I said, I need another goddamn ensign like I need, you know, a hole in the head. He said, we don't need him. So he looked at my file again, and he said, you're a lawyer. I said, that's right. He said, are you admitted to the bar? I said, yeah, I'm admitted to the bar. So he calls the district naval officer. Because it was a naval command, they had a district naval officer. So he calls this captain over there and says, I got this ensign lawyer over here. He says, send him over. I had temporary duty there for 45 days. And during 45 days, I think I did 42 courts martials. And as defense counsel, which was the crappy end of the deal, as you could tell, including a death penalty case, which was very interesting. Coincidences of life. Because of that independent duty thing, and because of the decision that the captain made, when that temporary duty was over, he sent me back to Philadelphia. Thank you. To the Naval Air Command, GSSO, ASO up at Robbins Avenue in North Philadelphia, big base up there, supply base. The captain, who had just gotten that command, Bob Northwood, when I showed up, Bob said, "Nifty guy," subsequently became vice president of Mead Paper. First rate guy. He said, "Bob, you're here." He said, "I don't have a billet in this command under lieutenant commander that is available at this time." He said, "But I look at your experience and your maturity, and I think that you can handle this job." So he said, "You will be in charge of all contract administration, which is the purchase contracts for all of the hardware and equipment in the Navy ships, including the nuclear subs, including everything." And I was an ensign at that time. About 2 weeks later, I got my other, and I became a JG. So I was a JG and a lieutenant commander of the billet, and kept that for the rest of my tour of duty. And that's where I was out of the Navy. All right. The experience in law school with Jeff Forty in the municipal law, legislative, regulatory stuff gave me instruction that was so valuable to my job down here in Washington when I finally ended up here as a lobbyist, as an association manager, as an industry manager. If I had been really smart, look at the fortuity of this. The municipal law part of bonding and everything, if I had followed that, I would have ended up like Bill Simon. Well, Bill Simon is a billionaire today. My career path went in a different direction because when I got out of the Navy, all the experience I had in purchasing and dealing with people in industry, one of the things I did was to restructure the procurement system for paint. Navy buys a lot of paint. The Navy was single service procurement for all paint, for all of the services, and I ran that. And I created that system, or reformed the system. The guy who was the head of the Paint and Coatings Association, National Paint Varnish and Lacquer Association at that time, was interested in me. His number two guy, he was a general, his number two was a colonel. The colonel came to see me, and I worked with them because all of their members were interested in procurement at that time, because bid business was important to, you know, the Sherwin-Williamses and the Gliddens and the DuPonts and a lot of that people, because that kept them in overhead. And there were a lot of small companies in there that weren't too honest or ethical, and they were the problem. So because of my Navy experience, because of my law school experience, because of the fortuity that when I got out, I said, "I'm not going back to practice law." I went around, and Jeff Fordham sent me to some of the best firms in town, and I had, at that time, three children and the fourth on the way. And the $7,000 a year was all that they could make available to you to start. And Red Elliott, Colonel Red Elliott from National Paint, Varnish, and Lacquer Association came up to see me. He said, "Bob," he said, "would you be interested in coming to Washington?" And like that, I said, "Yeah, I think I'd like that." That's how I got to Washington. It's that simple. If I hadn't volunteered to go to the Navy, if I hadn't done a lot of other things. All of those experiences ended up, one of the best things, people said, geez, why did you ever enlist? Didn't you? You wasted 4 years. I learned more in those 4 years about management. I mean, I had hundreds of people that I was responsible for. Millions and millions of dollars. I closed down the nuclear submarine program at one time because I defaulted a contractor. I closed down the whole Pacific fleet because I wouldn't allow them to land or take off any airplanes because the foam, firefighting foam that had been sent, wasn't up to spec. And I froze the whole system. I had, you know, Admiral Rickover call me on the phone and cut me a new one. You can't do this. And I said, I'm sorry, Admiral, it's my responsibility. You know, and Bob Northwood said, you're right, he's wrong, I'll stand behind you. Jeff Fordham, you're right, I'm now secure in my knowledge that you've researched this, I stand behind you, I'll publish it. Those were things that to me as a manager I learned, you know, so that when I manage 300 people here and the lawyers come in and the scientists come in and the you know, the lobbyists come in and say, this is what we have to do, this is right, good, I'll stand behind you. I never was afraid to do that. Because the other thing I learned from my experiences, particularly law school, was I knew how to think. I knew how to solve problems. I knew how to analyze problems. So I knew that the spade work, the research work, the vetting, the peer reviewing, the best talent had been applied. And that's not risk. That just takes a little courage, takes a little bit of leadership, takes a little bit of foresight. And without that, you don't get anywhere. So that's what my educational background is, and that's
Very interesting. I have a couple brief questions just to back up a little bit. Going to college, you had no one in your family that had college experience.
That's correct. And my uncles had gone to college, yes. Okay. My uncles and my aunts. My mother was the oldest. Well, she was the second oldest in the family, but she got married relatively early. And my father was a wealthy man. I mean, they had cars and speedboats and weekends at the Bellevue and all of that, so that was not a matter of concern until it cratered.
So it was it your real decision to enter college yet? Were you pushed?
It was never
into
a question in my mind. Okay. My father and my mother both encouraged me, of course.
Okay.
Of course they did. But there was never a question in my mind but that I wouldn't go. I was, one of the things that I always said, I was a reader. My best gifts at Christmas were always books. And I always was fascinated, and to this day I'm fascinated, by people in their careers, biography, how they got there. And I always admired, you know, the leaders of industry and the leaders of the world. I'd say, well, you know, how did this happen? And, you know, I've looked at it very carefully, and there is an enormous degree of fortuity involved in all of this. Whether it be family money or this path versus that path. And I tell you, you know, I often look and I see Bill Simon, who I know and worked with Bill when he was here in Washington at Treasury and after that. Bill is a brilliant man and, as I said, made fortunes by doing what he has done in the bond market. As I look back, you know, I say, boy, I was so lucky that I took the path I did. I did very well financially. But that's irrelevant. I worked with the best people, the most creative, concerned, committed people. I mean, there's not another industry in the world, given my choice, that I would take over the chemical industry. Not another. And the abuse that this industry takes, in spite of its good intentions and good works, has always been a catalyst to me, you know, to fight harder and to justify and to try and convince people that you are overlooking one of the great values that exist in the world and great industries. So, you know, I look back and I said, practice of law. I enjoyed court work. I was great at moot court. You know, I can obviously talk. I can obviously communicate. I've done it throughout my career here in Washington. My fathers used to say to me, "Do you miss the practice of law?" I said, "Dad, I practice law every day." And I said, it's just, you know, a different kind of law. And I will tell you something. What I created in CMA is probably the best boutique law firm in this town. We've got 15 attorneys on staff here. You know, we spend millions on our legal advocacy function. And I managed those people. I brought them here. I trained them. I worked with them. And to me, that's a great benefit. I enjoyed it. And I knew enough that I could manage them and not interfere.
Just out of curiosity, you handled an awful lot of court-martial cases in the Navy in a short period of time. Was that unusual?
No. It was one of the characteristics that troubled me the most, and a lesson that I learned in personnel as well. These were all desertion cases, or AWOL cases. And every one of them I lost. Every single one of them. And I lost because it was obvious that these kids did not understand their responsibilities. And for that I blame the Navy. And it was a lesson to me. Number one, almost every one of these kids had poor education. Number two, almost every one of them came from a broken family or no good parental guidance. Number three, they joined the Navy because they thought they were going to get something better than where they were. If you stopped and looked at their background, their whole history of experience was if they didn't like something, they walked away from it. Went to work at the Safeway. Well, screw, I don't like that. Went to work at a gas station. Well, my hands got dirty. Went to work for an automotive repair shop. Well, it's noisy in there. I don't like that. Went to work somewhere. Well, the guy promised me this and he didn't give it to me. So they look at the Navy or the military and they say, three hots and a flop. They go down to the recruiter and they say, "I want to work with airplanes." The guy says, "Sure, you can work with airplanes in the Navy." Or, "I want to go to sea." "Sure, you can go to sea at the Navy." Or, "I want to do this." "Sure, we'll let you do that." And the next thing you know, the kid finds that instead of being on an aircraft carrier where he wants to be, you know, he's swabbing out toilets at some land facility, or he's working in a motor pool, or he's working in a food function, and he says, "I don't like this," so he walks. He goes off on liberty on the weekend, decides, "I'm not going to go back." Just chucks the uniform. Well, it's different. You raised your hand. See? That was what it was all about.
Okay.
And every case was the same. It was just like a cookie cutter. And the result was the same. They all got dishonorable discharges, and they all got, you know, brig time, and they all got kicked out. And it was sad. It was truly sad. And, you know, the most I could do, which I did, and the ultimate of this was the death penalty case that I tried, which was a man under almost the same circumstances who was during the time of war, though. Went AWOL, met a girl, went home with her to her uncle's farm. To make the long story short, this was a guy with not a lot of education again, but he fell in love with this girl and married her, lived with the uncle. Her uncle was not aware that he was military. Had five or six children, ended up running the farm, which was a dairy farm. And then he was apprehended. This is some 20 years later, almost. His children were there. Everybody was a hardworking, fine person, everything else. When I first met them and this case was given to me, I said, "Look, you guys have got to get outside counsel on this. I said, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be here. I'm not qualified to handle something of this magnitude. This is going to be an appeal, an appeal, an appeal. I said, you better find yourself an attorney. And I found them a law firm in Charleston and got them outside counsel, and the uncle was paying the outside counsel. And this guy was convicted. He was convicted. It was sad. Now, it went on appeal, and he did not get the death penalty. He did get a dishonorable discharge, and he did get a jail term out of this thing, which I found out subsequent. But I sat there, and there were captains. One of the captains, who was from the hospital that had treated me when I was over in the hospital at Charleston, and this guy had tears coming down his face. You know, and I went up and spoke to him. I said, you know, this is just the extreme of what you and I have been looking at for the past 2 months. I said, every one of these kids that comes in here is just as sad a case, in my opinion.